Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Justine, I think you know who my guest is this week.
John Morgan Wilson. We're republishing all of his Benjamin Justice books. The one we have out now is Simple Justice.
And he does talk about Recurred Tales. He thinks it's great what you guys are doing. So he did a plug for you.
That's wonderful. I want to do a plug for the independent bookstores out there. We're now in the Christmas shopping season, and your independent bookstores need your help to stay afloat, especially now that there's pandemic. If they don't have the books in stock, any book, they will order it for you as long as it's in print. So you can order any of the Recurred Tales books. You can order any of Brad's books. And it helps. It gets you a nice Christmas gift to give and also helps keep those independent bookstores alive.
There are very few books that you can't order from your local bookstore.
Right. And, in Pasadena here, the Romans was about to go under and they made a community pitch and everybody went and ordered online, picked things up curbside. And the Strand bookstore in New York City had a similar experience. So get out there, buy from your local bookstore and keep them going and get other people in your community to do that. That's the only way we're going to save these people, these little businesses, as we get through this pandemic.
Yes, we don't have to rely on, the one big guy that's left.
Well, yes. The home ordering and getting delivery is very attractive. But I'll get off my soapbox about please order from your independent bookstores.
It was a good one.
Okay.
What you got for us?
I have The Magic Box, which is done by Scott Thrower. It's the first book in his Arcane History series. It is a paranormal book. So if you like the other paranormal books that I've recommended, like Jordan Hawk and A.L. Lester books, this will be work for you. If you're not into those, this isn't your cup of tea, skip right over. And next week I'll have a more traditional PI book to recommend. Magic Box is set in World War I. The main characters are Charles, who's a diabetic and works at a museum. The museum is the Royal Ontario Museum, which was built in real life and also in the book in 1914, just a couple years before. And Henry, his lover, who is a medical student, and medical student is stretching it. The in World War I, Canada needed a lot of doctors. And so the admission to medical school was not much higher than you can read. However, Henry is a very, very astute. He studies everything he can, and he has particularly studied Charles's diabetes. They didn't have insulin back in World War I. And so at the beginning of the book, Charles is only a few months to live, and to extend his life, he has to fast until his blood sugar drops. And so Henry tests his blood sugar all the time using some method that is incredibly more complicated than the finger sticks we do today. And once his sugar gets down low enough, then he can actually eat a meal. And he is skeletal thin, and this is not going to prolong his life beyond an extra month or two.
That really sucks during that time.
Yeah, it really does suck. As many things suck during that time, including World War I.
Exactly. Well, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway, it starts with Charles being woken in the middle of the night by his professor that he mentors under and having to go to the museum. Henry is very, very concerned, wants to go with him. And the professor says, no, this is not something you can accompany us to. So it's very mysterious. When they get there, they go down to the very lowest basement where there is a solid stone box with runes covering it.
That sounds ominous.
It sounds ominous. And there are two Americans down there. And one is a professor from Boston And they have a number of men hiding in the shadows with guns. They want Charles, who is the expert on obscure magic, to open this box. And Charles says, well, you know, I study it, but it's not real. Despite that, he looks at the box. The runes on the box start to move around and transform themselves into English. Nobody else can see this but Charles. The author describes it all far better than I could. Suffice to say that he opens the box and magic comes pouring out.
So it reminds me of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but instead of melting people, magic pops out.
It reminds me of Pandora's box, because all those evil things and a beast actually explodes out. They find out later that there's a beast that has been leashed upon Toronto, and they have to stop the beast, and they want to use magic to cure Charles. The rest of what they do, it's kind of like those horror movies where you say, don't go in the basement, and they go in the basement, but they have to go in the basement, not because they're running towards something, but because they want to cure his diabetes and also stop this monster. And so the mystery is, you know, catching the monster, where the monster is if it's a criminal. And then Professor Goddard, who is the American professor from Boston, wants this magic so he can control it. And they want to stop him. From there we go and set out upon a very intense, thrilling mystery. And this gets a thrilling recommendation.
Thrilling recommendation. And this really disturbs me, because I always thought Toronto was a pretty safe, cool place.
You know, I thought it was a safe, cool place, but apparently, if this is to be believed, and I have no reason to think he's completely made it up out of whole cloth, there was a great fire at the beginning of the 19th century. There were slums like the slums that were in London at the time. The rivers were being, you know, paved over for the expansion of the city, and that resulted in a lot of health problems. And it sounded like a not pleasant place at that time. Plus, everybody was going off to war, because Canada is part of the United Kingdom. And when the United Kingdom went to war, they were part of it. And the United States was not in the war yet. But war was taking a huge number of young men out of Canada. The grounds of the university were set up as a training camp. There were soldiers marching around, and they were living outside in tents as you move into winter, so they could get used to going the conditions were at the front. It was certainly not a pleasant time in 1916.
No, it doesn't sound like that. And it surprised me that they, it shouldn't surprise me that they went to war before we did. I never think of them as a Canadian province or a
part of the kingdom.
Yeah. But so that's surprising to me.
Yeah. I thought it has, you know, as you read through things, you kind of pick up minor historical bits that you kind of have overlooked. Canada's participation in World War I, I don't think is anything I've seen mentioned in what I've read before. And I'm sure all our Canadian listeners will now be up in arms at our inability to like pay attention to Canadian history.
Yeah, here in the U.S., we are terrible about world history if it doesn't involve us. So we will acknowledge that is true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let me just say one more thing about the author.
Okay.
Scott Thrower has a podcast out, and it retells fairy tales in a unique manner, and we will put it up in the show notes so that you can link to it.
Absolutely. We get a thrilling recommendation for the magic box.
See you next week.
Okay. See you then, Justine. Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. John Morgan Wilson is a veteran journalist, TV news and documentary writer, and a fiction writer. In addition to having published novels, his short fiction has appeared in Elderly Queen Mystery Magazine, Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, Blythe House Quarterly, and numerous anthologies. For 30 years, he served as an instructor with the UCLA Extension Writers Program. He lives with his longtime companion, artist Pietro Gamino, in West Hollywood, California, the primary setting for the Benjamin Justice series. Hello, John.
Hi, Brad. Good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I'm going to start out right off the bat, and I have to ask you this. How does it feel to be an icon?
Yeah, I always say if I were an icon, I'd be rich. So I don't think of myself as an icon, even remotely.
You know, my circles that I talk to readers and writers, you certainly are. But hey, remember, Van Gogh only sold one painting during his lifetime.
Well, I appreciate that. And in fact, a friend of mine, a woman who writes thrillers, she's an international bestseller, and she once said to me, you're iconic, and I was shocked. I didn't know where that came from, but I hear it once in a while, and I guess it's because of the Edgar Award and you know, the Benjamin Justice series. That's the only way I can figure it, because that was sort of a groundbreaking deal.
Yeah, and you have had quite a few accolades. The Benjamin Justice novel, the first one, Simple Justice, was recently released by Record Tales, and it's the first release Edgar Allan Poe Award from the Mystery Writers of America for Best Supporting Novel in 1997. So your first novel, you're getting an Edgar Award.
Well, it won the Edgar in the Best First Novel category. So that's a whole different animal than the Best Novel category for an Edgar, which is the most distinguished and honor in all of mystery writing. I think most mystery buffs would agree with that. The Edgar for Best First Novel is kind of way down there, like a Supporting Actor Award. I don't mean to diminish supporting actors at all. Character actors are my favorite types to watch. But so that's, we have to say that about the Edgar. I'm not trying to put myself in the best novel category. That's a real big time honor. But I was reportedly at the time the first gay mystery author of a gay themed novel ever to win an Edgar, who was an openly gay author. So it kind of was groundbreaking in that sense, and it got a lot of attention because of that, and it certainly helped give the Benjamin Justice series more prominence. And I just rewrote that first novel 25 years later, and it's just been released, as you said, by Requeered Tales, which I refer to as RQT. And it's just been released in a revised 25th anniversary edition with a foreword by Christopher Rice. And I'm now at work on the second one. We're going to release all 8 Benjamin Justice mysteries over the next 2 to 3 years, if I can keep up with the revisions, because I want to try to improve each one of them as we go along. It's a big task.
First of all, I had Christopher Rice as a guest, and he gave rave reviews about you. He really likes you a lot. He was very charming to have on. With the re-release, you do new edits and new writing. Is that correct?
Really a lot. What happened was that when, we may get around to how Requeered Tales was founded and got started, but I'll shorten it for now. And if you want to get into that later, I think it's a fascinating story and an important story to tell. But Requeered Tales wanted to bring back all 8 Benjamin Justice mysteries because they were finally going out of print or had gone out of print. I wasn't really planning to do anything with them. I kind of moved on, was writing short stories and essays and things. And but they wanted to bring them back. So I reread Simple Justice, the first one, for the first time in 25 years. And I just was unhappy with an awful lot of the writing. And I found plot problems, plot inconsistencies, timeline issues. There were cliches that made me groan. Just a lot of ragged writing, I felt. And I told them I wanted to rewrite all 8 books before they were released. And that's what I've set about doing. And I finished Simple Justice earlier this year and did heavy, heavy rewriting on it. The story is essentially intact. The plot is essentially intact. But I cut a couple of characters, added a couple of new ones, cut a couple of subplots, tighten things down, trying to sharpen the writing here and there, and I'm happier with it now. I'm never happy, completely happy with anything I write, but this is a point when I had to let it go. We had deadlines, or I'd probably still be rewriting it.
Tell you on the show, I don't get to read every guest's novels. And a lot of the reason is that they're newer novelists, and I've been working my way through some of the older classic novels. So I did read your book, Simple Justice, and I loved it.
God bless you.
Oh, thank you for that. Thank you. It was entertaining. So thank you for that. Benjamin Justice is the character in the novel. Would you describe him to us? What type of man he is?
Benjamin Justice is he's kind of a bitter, angry man. He's grieving the loss of a lover from AIDS when the book opens, with a book set in 1994, set in West Hollywood in 1994, which is a pivotal election year, and mirrored a lot of the things that are going on now. The epidemic then was AIDS. The new drugs for AIDS, the AIDS cocktail, wasn't out and available to the public yet. And he was mourning the loss of his lover. And he was a dark, angry man who was a recluse. And he had was a journalist, a reporter, and had been worked for the Los Angeles Times. And he destroyed his career by fabricating a series that won a Pulitzer, but was found to be fabricated, and he destroyed his career. And the book, Simple Justice, the first one, explores a separate murder mystery that he gets involved in very reluctantly. But at the same time, we learn his backstory and why he fabricated that series and destroyed, which was so self-destructive for him. It's a very dark novel, and he's a very dark, complex man, given to violence at times, heavy drinker. And that's the protagonist that carries the novel in the first person voice. It's a pretty potent first person voice.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons I like it. I really like first person voice.
Yeah, well, he's got a strong one. He's very opinionated, and he goes off on discursive rants here and there. And what was interesting about writing the series was, at one point, one of my editors, the first four novels were published by Doubleday, the second four by St. Martin's Press. And one of my editor at St. Martin's Press once said to me, I wrote one of the novels in a very tight fashion. I wanted to really give it pace. And you saw a lot of thrillers coming out, and people were, their short attention spans were taking over. So I thought I was going to write a really fast-paced novel. And I remember when I turned it in, it was, the seventh or eighth book in the series. And my editor, I had a very good editor, Keith Kayla at St. Martin's Press, very insightful guy. And he got the book and he read it, and he called me and said, "We can publish it as it is. It's a good book, but I miss that voice of Benjamin Justice, the way he goes off on rants. I miss the discursiveness of your books. I think that's what readers like about him." And that was so surprised me, because usually discursive is a dirty word in writing, fiction writing or otherwise. It's, you don't want to go off on tangents. You don't want to, you want to stay on track. But that's one of the keys to the character, I think, that he talks in this almost stream of consciousness voice at times. So he's always just infusing the material. You see everything from his point of view, and he's fast to have impulses, fast to have judgments, fast to correct himself, fast to investigate. And, you know, you're going to love him or hate him, but a lot of readers have hated him and still wanted to read the books and continue to read the books. I hear from those readers all the time.
Yeah. Were there other things that you find challenging in writing a series?
Yeah, you know, the second book, which I'm rewriting now, which will be out sometime next year, meaning 2021, the second book, I knew when I finished it that I barely got the book written. I was writing in television by then, and I was between gigs and wrote the book between TV jobs. And I'd finished the first book. It had won the Edgar, been nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. And after I won the Edgar, Michael Connelly sent me a really nice note congratulating me. He'd won the Edgar for Black Echo a few years before me. We'd both worked at the LA Times. We both left the LA Times in the early 90s. I didn't know him. He worked on the hard side of the paper, covering the police beat and crime stories, and was well on his way with the Black Echo to becoming the major writer, the important writer that he is today. Our paths never crossed when we were at the Times, but I met him soon enough. Afterward, he's just a terrific guy and so supportive and so down to earth and accessible. He sent me this note congratulating me on winning the Edgar, the same Edgar for Best First that he'd won for Black Echo a few years before. But he offered some advice, and he gave me a warning. He said, give yourself plenty of time when you write the second novel, because second novels are in a series or at any time are often much more difficult to write, because the first, and I think what he was getting at, was that we write our first novels and we put a lot into them. They're the book we've been waiting to write all our lives. And we put a lot into them, and we have so much passion and energy and drive, and we're free of the constraints of business and a contract and deadlines and commercial pressures. Then you get to your second book. When I wrote Sold Simple Justice, Doubleday signed me up to write three more books in the series. They bought Simple Justice and signed me to write three more. And suddenly, it's not just a labor of love, this passion piece that you're writing. It's a real job. It's real work. It shouldn't be a job, but it is real work. And you've got to really get down to it. And it's a whole different feeling about it in that, on the second book. Anyway, Michael sent me that note, and he warned me, give yourself plenty of time. The problem was that I got that note too late, and the second book was already in production, and I knew it wasn't a really good book, but I took it as far as I could at the time. So when I reread it about 3 months ago, getting ready to rewrite it for RQT to come out next year, I found how really, really bad it was, how much work it needed. So I'm now in the midst of cutting thousands and thousands of words, cutting some terrible writing, some really bad characterization, bad settings, and so forth. And that's my second novel. And I just am so grateful for the chance to do some rewriting, and I hope to make it better. It's called Revision of Justice. There's an irony in that title. And I'm giving it revisions almost as we speak.
Well, I'm finding it interesting that you're telling me that you did all this bad writing. And it was over a period of 10 years that you wrote Benjamin Justice. Out of those seven, total eight novels, six of them were nominated by Lambda Literary for Best Gay Mystery. And out of those, you earned the Lammy Award itself. And you've got the Edgar Award for Best First Novel. Running 10 years with Benjamin Justice, why did you stay with him so long?
Well, you know, first of all, it came along at a time when I was getting older. I was in my 50s. Benjamin Justice came out, I believe I was 50 when I wrote it. It might have come out when I was 51. I'd moved into television. It was a new field for me, and I needed the income to supplant my TV gigs when I was getting established in television. So I suddenly had this contract, and I wanted to write the series at first, and then I found out I may not be a series writer, and it became much more of a challenge than I suspected. Some people are cut out to write series, some are not. I suspect I'm not, but I did continue to write it, and I ended up kind of getting back in the rhythm of it. Once I got past that second novel, I think I found my voice again. I found my rhythm again. I settled down, and I was able to make more time in my schedule to write those books. And unfortunately, I got Michael's advice too late on that. So I did start to do better. The books came back, and I enjoyed writing them. And you're right. I won a few Lambda Literary Awards along the way. Six of the eight books were nominated, but I can tell you the second one was not nominated, and it shouldn't have been. it needed a lot more work, and it's getting a lot more work now. And I just hope I can bring it up to snuff. I think I'll be able to do it. It's interesting, too. You go back to a book you wrote 25 years ago, you're going to see it completely differently. You're more mature. You've been around more. Your skills have sharpened. You're probably a better writer than you were there. You probably should be. You might be getting older and your energy's flagging, but your skills are apt to be much more deft, and you can bring more to it. You can bring perspective and maturity to it that you didn't have back then. And so it's always good. I mean, when you're writing, if you're going to rewrite, you need to write a rough draft and put it away for as long as you can before you come back to it, because you're going to come back to it with a set of fresh eyes and see a lot of mistakes, see a lot of things jump off the page at you. And I just didn't have that time with that second book. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, but I'm so, so grateful for this opportunity to get another shot at it. And I'm going to keep doing this with all the books if my endurance holds up, and just seeing what I can do to make them better.
Now, you talked about being on television. You were a producer. In addition to that, your career began as a freelance journalist, and you wrote columns for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and more. Did you have that passion for journalism as number one, or did you see it as a means to starting a career in fiction writing?
Well, I want to clear up one thing if I could. I didn't write columns for the New York Times or the LA Times. I wrote articles for the New York Times and the LA Times and many other newspapers and magazines. But I wrote a column for Writer's Digest for 15 years. But to make it to the top as a columnist for the New York Times was way beyond my reach at that time. I broke into the New York Times when I was in my late 20s, and I never was a columnist there. But I appreciate you mentioning those. I did write for them. What happened was I went off to college not knowing what I was really going to do. I was kind of a lost kid as a teenager. I went off to college. I was 17 when I started at Michigan State. And when I left high school to go away to Michigan State, my wrestling coach, high school wrestling coach, Jack Fernandez, terrific, terrific mentor and father figure to a lot of us back then, great coach. He said to me, what are you going to major in? What are you going to do? And I said, I didn't really know what I was going to do. He said, you're going to be a writer. I know you're going to be a writer, because I'd done a little writing in high school, but I was never on the school newspaper or anything like that. I never really showed much chops as a writer, mm-hmm. but he was really quite a remarkable man. The insights he had into individual wrestlers on his teams. And he said, yeah, you're going to be a writer. I can tell. And that just blew me away. No one had ever said that to me, not my mother, who was an English teacher, not my father, who was a doctor. And I went off with that thought embedded in my head. And it made me think more broadly, think more deeply about things. And I was a college dropout 2 years later. I didn't do well in college. I was floundering around. And I came home at 19, and I ended up becoming a stringer for the South Bay Daily Breeze, which is a regional paper down here. Mm-hmm. Had a circulation of about 50,000. I started covering sports for them as a stringer, and I loved it, immediately loved it. And I went back to college, got a journalism degree, worked my way through school writing for newspapers, and I started freelancing for magazines, and that's how I broke in. And I just continued from there. I was publishing a little alternative political newspaper, Easy Reader, at the end of the 60s. And I think it was 70, 71, 72, right in there. Published it for a couple of years before turning it over to my friend Kevin Cody, who publishes it today, more than 50 years later. And I just kept going. And I really wanted to freelance. I don't like jobs. I don't like being under the authority of anybody. I really wanted to write what I wanted to write when I could, if I could scratch out a living. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So it's been since I was about 19, 20 years old that I've managed to work a living as a freelance writer and journalist. I wrote, sold some screenplays, got into television, doing a lot of news and documentary writing and a little producing. I didn't like that, so I tried to stick just with the writing. And then I started writing novels, short stories, advertising, radio spots. I loved writing radio spots. So it's been a real eclectic patchwork journey as a writer, but it's been real satisfying.
I'm glad you brought up the Easy Reader, because I live in the Los Angeles South Bay, which is where it generally is the market for the Easy Reader. And after how many years, it's still being published today.
Yeah, 51, I think.
But you found it. Do you believe that was a bold step for that time in 1970 to be writing an alternative newspaper?
No, actually, you know, actually, I've always been a late bloomer. So, I mean, the underground press, the L.A. Free Press, the L.A. Weekly later came along, L.A. Reader, the Village Voice in New York. There were underground newspapers, as we called them back then, all over the place. So when I founded Easy Reader in 1970, I was really coming to the party late. I was inspired by the other papers, and I had done a couple of pieces for the LA Free Press. In fact, they never paid me, so I'm still waiting for that check, but I think it was like $15 or something. And I had a piece in the LA Reader, and they did pay me, I gotta say that. But so I was had dabbled in underground newspaper writing when I was going to college and after college, and then I found an Easy Reader when I was still in my early 20s and mid-20s, right around in there. No, I just did it on impulse, like I do a lot of things. And I was home one day. I'd hitchhiked around one summer, 69, with a buddy, all over the country and up through Canada. And I came back, and then I went down to Mexico for 5 months with another buddy. Our surfboards stacked in the van, and had a lot of adventures down there. And I came back. And I was sitting on my patio, and the patio of my mother's house. And I said, God, what am I going to do next? I just said, I want to do a little paper in Hermosa Beach. They really could use a great little alternative paper, because all they have is the Daily Breeze, which ironically was where I first started writing at 19. And it was a conservative paper, and the other voices on the other side weren't being heard. And it was being dominated by developers and a police chief who was doing a lot of bad stuff. And so we founded, I founded Easy Reader, put out the call for volunteers, got a group of terrific people together, and we started putting out a little paper. And I waited tables at night to pay my bills. And I published the paper for 2 years until I burned out, and Kevin Cody took over, and God bless him. And he made a go of it. I'm not a businessman. And I knew I wasn't going to last with it, and I was burning out. I was kind of a 60s burnout for a while. And then I came out after Kevin took over the paper. I came out as a gay man, and another life change. And, you know, that so it was a big turning point time in my life, the early 70s.
Well, other than waiting tables, you make it sound like starting a newspaper is easy. So, and I'm sure it wasn't as easy as came across.
Well, you know, back then you could we printed 3,000 copies for about $400. 3,000 copies of a 12 to 16 page paper, offset printing, for about $400 each issue. And we had all volunteers. Nobody ever made any money off that paper. We paid Hal Heiner, our cartoonist, who did all of our graphics, $25. And because he had just had a little baby. He was 17, 18 years old, and he and Vanessa had just had a little baby. And so I gave him any money we could scrape together. And he got $25 a week, but he was the only one who got paid. And when I turned the paper over to Kevin, there were no assets really, except the name of the paper, which I'd registered, and a loyal readership, and let Kevin run with it. And I walked away and kind of never looked back. And then recently wrote an essay on the 50th anniversary of the paper, kind of summing all this up that Kevin published. And, you know, I was happy to see it keep going, and I moved on to other things and broke into the LA Times, the New York Times eventually while I was still in my late 20s and around 30, and then started freelancing full time after that. A lot of magazines managed to make a go of it. It wasn't easy. You got to work a real grind if you're going to freelance full time and make a living at it. And I managed to do it.
That would be very hard for me to do. Have you continued to read newer novels that are being published today?
You know, I don't. I'm still working on an old stack of older ones. Every once in a while, I will buy a new novel up at Book Soup. But I got to tell you, I just finished a mystery, but it was In a Lonely Place, which was published back in the 40s, with an afterword by Megan Abbott. And it was fascinating to read, and I really enjoyed it, and really enjoyed her postscript on that novel. And it was so interesting reading it again after all these years. I first read it probably 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And I don't read a lot of newer novels, and especially when I'm writing, I don't read fiction. Mm-hmm. Because I worry about the voice of that novelist getting in the way of my voice that I want to sustain as I write, because voice is so important to carrying any novel. And mine is a very kind of strong first-person voice, so it's particularly important to me. So that was the last novel I read just before I started my current rewrite. I wrote it between finishing my rewrite on Simple Justice and then starting this second novel. That's the last novel I knocked off. Enjoyed it a lot.
Well, this is probably going to be difficult to answer then, since you are reading older novels, but have you seen changes or aware of changes that have taken place with mystery novels since when you first started?
They've opened up so much in terms of diversity of material, diversity of content, potent points of view that you didn't see back then, especially from an LGBT angle. It used to be very ghettoized, and that's opened up. And there are a lot more gay mystery writers writing now, and some of them aren't stuck in a narrow category area. Some of them are writing what would be thought of as non-genre or literary novels that have a strong gay background. Now, those started recently, obviously. Great gay novels have been around forever. Great LGBT novels have been around for forever, going back a century or two. It's just that there are more people with more opportunities across a broad spectrum of sexuality. That's certainly a big change. When I came into it, Joseph Hansen had really gotten established in the 70s and had broken ground as the premier mystery writer of gay-themed fiction, crime fiction, mystery fiction. He kind of set the gold standard. He was the first one that really got attention and sold some books in the mainstream. And of course, Michael Nava followed later. Richard Stevenson came along, and many others came along. And Michael sort of carried the torch, and I think he won like 5 Lammys, you know. And then I came along and won a few Lammys in the Edgar in the 90s. And I brought a whole different kind of temperament and tone and voice to the way mine was tougher, darker, more raw, I think, more sexual. And, the fact that my books, as sexual as they can be, was published by Doubleday, one of the biggest publishers in the world, a mainstream publisher, and they never asked me to tone any of the sexuality down. I wrote something not long ago, and it was getting into that area, and I said, I don't think they bought the book despite its gay material and how provocative and frank that's the sexuality was expressed. I think they bought it for those reasons. It was different. It was distinctive. And a lot of people didn't like it. And some people did like it. And, it won the Edgar Award. So some Edgar judges liked it, at least 3. And there were five on the panel, on the committee. So at least 3 liked it. And so that was a big change right there. Hansen was a big change. Novel was a big change. I was a big change. Christopher Rice came along, big national bestseller. And now he's, he's out of thrillers and he's into fantasy writing. And, he's going to be around for a long time doing his thing. And he's also he's younger, so he's really good at marketing and integrating, other kinds of ways to promote his books, but also just integrate it all with his podcast and the things he does in that vein. with his friend Eric. And so, yeah, there's a lot of opportunities have opened up, and just the way they have in all ways, in so many ways for the LGBT community. And yet there's so much yet to do. And I hope nobody drops the ball and lets us slide back, because we're in an era where we're seeing some pretty dark stuff happen at the top of the political scale.
I've been talking with John Morgan Wilson, whose first novel, Simple Justice, has been re-released by Weirquart Tales.
Thank you, Brad, so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, you've been a wonderful guest. I thank you for taking the time.
Okay, let's talk again soon.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.